Join me, Jacqueline Coley, on a brand new podcast, Seen on the Screen, presented by Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes. Meet the innovative people at NBC Universal as they share their journeys, inspirations, and the movies that shape them. Each episode is an intimate and fun conversation about the impact of film. Seen on the Screen is available now. You can find it on Apple, Spotify, YouTube, or wherever you find your favorite podcasts.
The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back one last time to Rotten Tomatoes is Wrong. This is actually our penultimate show now, but this is the last time that we'll be talking about a movie on this podcast. It's been an amazing run that Jacqueline announced on our last episode where we covered Teen Witch and then dropped the bombshell that, okay, we got one more. But man, what a way to go out and what a guest to have with us. We have esteemed screenwriter, podcaster, critic Brandon Collins from Medium Popcorn, from Black Drunk History. You and I hit it off. I think that we worked together like 35, 40, 80 years ago. And yeah. Then we rekindled during, we were doing Doug Loves Movies together live. And we're like, I think I know you.
Yep.
And we just hit it off and we've been trying to get this done ever since.
Yeah, absolutely, man. Thank you for having me. We both lost that one too. I'm very competitive with Drunk Loves Movies. I want to beat Mark. And then we both lost. I'm like, well, that's ironic.
Were you on the same episode with Dan too?
Jacqueline Coley here as always.
Sorry.
I've been on with Dan, but I don't think that one was with Dan.
Okay.
No, that was with Paige. I'm blanking on her name.
Right.
And Matt Walsh.
From Criminal Minds.
Oh,
yeah, that
wow.
was the last, that was the live show. And then we did a few virtual ones, I think.
Yeah, right. Yeah. It's a fun show, and his show's been running for over a decade now.
Yeah.
But we've had a pretty good jog here, Jacqueline.
Yeah. We had a good one. 4 years, I would say that's a great mile with it. But I just know that I've seen you do that podcast, and I think it was with Dan Pearl. I'm like, how many times have you done this
We
podcast?
Did it live at Comic-Con.
That's what it is. I was like, I've seen you do this. And
the Comic-Con ones are fun because, like, before, when Brandon and I were in the green room here in L.A., we'd, you know, have a couple boxes of water. when you do the Comic-Con one, it's just like, how many beers can I drink before we actually start, before we get on stage? So.
It seems like a fun time. It's fun to watch, I will say that. But hey, look, I'm not saying that we would ever have rivaled the 10 years of Doug Loves Movies, but the 4 years that we got with this were pretty epic. I'm very glad that we're going out on a high note, because if we're going to have a last episode, it might as well be The Last Dragon.
Oh, yeah.
If you're doing something that is watchable, that is madcap, that is crazy, that is just a genre bending trip through the 1980s, The Last Dragon is it, Brandon Collins.
It is. It's one of the craziest movies I've ever seen, and it's still it still surprises me every time I watch it.
Yeah.
There's just so many, and it's kind of cool because there's a lot of things that you don't see black people do in this movie, like own a pizzeria.
wear the most Asian
gear,
Asian outfits.
Yeah, it's just insane. Eating popcorn with chopsticks. Like, it's a lot of wild stuff in this movie.
This movie, we haven't even scratched the surface, folks. And it's 61% fresh, which is, and it's not always been the case with The Last Dragon. See, here on Rotten Tomatoes is Wrong, we kind of pride ourselves on either defending movies that have been maligned by the tomato meter, or maybe taking the movie down a peg that just got a little too big for its britches with the tomato meter and what the critics said when it came out. The Last Dragon was a rotten movie, Jacqueline.
Yeah.
And it was rotten, making it a qualifier for our book, The Rotten Movies We Love. And this was in the cult classics section.
Yeah.
And it's gone up too fresh since its initial rotten tomato meter, in large part thanks to you, and this was one of your contributions to the book.
Yeah, we all got to pick specific ones that we wanted to write about when the book came out, and I was the first one to say The Last Dragon, and it was, again, it was at 59%, and so it was in that, like, questionable realm. There's a lot lower scores ones
fresh
on the
adjacent.
Fresh adjacent, but I was so happy that I got to do this one. I was just rereading it, like, looking up for this episode, and yeah, man, this was, I feel like if you're an anime kid, this was part of like a moment for you in movies. I think if you were a martial arts black kid, this was a moment for you in movies. It tapped into, again,
just a cultural sort of synergy. The Venn diagram of Black kids that like anime and Black kids that like action movies and Black kids that, you know, felt they missed out on the Blaxploitation of the 70s, like that is a round circle, you know, and this movie is kind of at the heart of it. And I as much as I know that the behind the scenes of this is not kind to it, I will always love Berry Gordy for setting out to make this happen.
Yeah, so Berry Gordy, the legendary, the hit maker of Motown, decides, I think I'm going to produce this movie. And you're right, it's got inspirations from, really, if you just look at the world, this is like Pangea. This is like everything. Yeah. You're incorporating stuff from all corners of the globe into this one story we're talking about. And I mean, it's 86% fresh with the audience. And so clearly the audience that comes to this movie and rewatches it. I mean, like our movie, the last time we were talking, Teen Witch, they still have screenings of this all over the place that will sell out because people just love celebrating the mayhem that is this movie in both a sincere way and we were all so young the first time we saw this movie. Brandon Collins, 39th anniversary is one of the reasons we're talking about this movie. Wow. It's almost 40 years young. Do you remember where you were when you first heard about The Last Dragon?
First heard about The Last Dragon when I was in high school. Mind you, I grew up in Ann Arbor, Michigan. I grew up in a suburb, so I didn't have much exposure to things like The Last Dragon in my friendship circle and everything. But my
pretty much just staying warm during the winter and go Wolverines. Right?
Yeah, but my friend Baron, he was because he was a producer, he played The Glow.
Yeah.
And like on the soundtrack, and I was like, "What is this?" He's like, "Dude, this is from The Last Dragon." I'm like, "What's The Last Dragon?" He's like, "You don't know The Last Dragon." But I didn't watch it until like my 20s. I didn't actually sit down and watch it, and I was like, this is wild. But to Jacqueline's point, though, like, now that I'm older, I've been doing, like, a lot of, like, stuff in the industry, I realized the representation, how important it was, and how, at the moment, this had to be, like, an incredible thing. This had to be, like, watching Black Panther.
Yeah.
Like, you're like, we never get to do this stuff. Like, as crazy, as incoherent as this movie is, there's so many things where you could tell, like, the crowd was probably losing their mind.
Right.
During this moment,
the kids got to see themselves on the big screen in a way that they never had before, that I think a lot of white kids just kind of took for granted from all those years of like white kids probably growing up watching like stuff like the like westerns back in like the 60s and then all through the 70s with like watching, you know, Chuck Norris or whoever the big action star at the time was. Bruce Lee was kind of that transcendent figure when he was around. But and so he is actually playing a huge factor in this movie, both behind the scenes and on the actual celluloid.
Well, I became aware of like how important, like especially in hip hop culture, like in the for a lot of Black people, like how much like because I wasn't really into kung fu stuff. I watched a lot of westerns. My grandfather's really into westerns, but the RZA talked about in the Tao Wu where he's like in the hood, like kung fu movies were like our jam. Like that's the thing, that was our escape. And so when you see how prominent Bruce Lee's featured in this, it makes a lot of sense. And just in regards to like where it fits in the movie and the culture and stuff like that.
I'll just add on top of that too. I think like, I mean, you look at obviously things like Wu-Tang. For me, the first time I saw The Last Dragon was actually, I forget what the Busta Rhymes video is where he is show nuff in the video, but that was the video.
Oh, right, right.
And the I football
was,
pads.
Yeah. There was my best friend at the time, she was in one of those crazy Christian families where they all had biblical names. Like Javar. It was like literally like, you know, like Malachi and Shamar and like everybody had a biblical name. But all of
Goliath,
her,
time for dinner.
Seriously, all of her brothers were older than her and they were all into The Last Dragon. And so we were watching the video on like MTV or not even MTV. It was like the version of MTV where you could choose it like a jukebox. And we were like trying to wait for the box video to come up for Busta Rhymes. And we were like watching that whole situation. And they were like, yeah, that's from The Last Dragon. We're like, what? What? Like we didn't know it was based off of something, which is actually interesting about and why I love the movie so much is it's influenced so much subsequent Black culture. I mean, there is literally an episode of Insecure where they're doing a screening for The Last Dragon in it.
So this is how dumb I am. I knew there was a movie called The Last Dragon. I probably could have recognized some images, but I saw The Last Dragon 1985. So immediately in my head when I realized we're doing this movie is I'm thinking, okay, dragon, because like dragons were huge in the 80s, like Game of Thrones and And How to Train Your Dragon is adorable for the kids today. Back in the 80s, every kid was obsessed with dragons. Yeah. You had like Dragon Slayer.
Dragonheart.
And Dragonheart was the 90s, but it was also still like, oh, the like let's tell a story with like a really cool dragon. I thought this was a cheesy 80s dragon movie. So I text
you
Brandon.
You'd be surprised.
Been trying to get Brandon on for a while. And Brandon's like, hey, I'll be in town. And I'm like, hey, have you heard of Scene of the Last Dragon by any chance? And like, I didn't see you because we were texting, but it felt like your face lit up when I presented this as an option.
Let's do this.
Absolutely. No.
61%.
I would question your black card if you texted a black man and they were like, what movie?
Yeah.
Like, I'd be like, where
were
you?
We literally talked about it on my movie podcast. Oh. Like, when we reviewed it, because like, it was like my third time seeing it. They were like, bro, like, every black person has to see this movie. Like,
there's
very few required films for black people, like, that you have to absolutely see. Otherwise, people raise eyebrows at you. And Last Dragon's one of them.
So let me ask you to do this, though, because Jacqueline and I now, like, putting the pressure on the guest.
Yeah.
If I were to ask you to give a surface-level synopsis of The Last Dragon, what would you say?
I would say it's about this lost brother who's been studying Kung Fu for a long time. And is trying to achieve the ultimate level. And his master gives him this like a very vague task of finding the master, right? And all the while, he has this antagonist, Shonuff, who essentially thinks he's the best. Bruce Leroy won't engage with him. So Shonuff is on the side, like doing everything he can to antagonize this guy into a confrontation. Meanwhile, there's a aspiring Tiffany wannabe singer who's trying to get her music videos on like this famous MTV-esque show that's ran by Vanity. Her boyfriend, who's this rich mobster kind of businessman, I don't know, he's scheming to get Vanity to put her stuff on the show. And all this intertwines because Bruce Leroy falls in love with Vanity's character. This is really hard because it's just so many different plot lines.
You're doing great so far.
Long story short, the bad guy who's trying to force Vanity into putting on his girlfriend on a platform. He kidnaps her. He hires all these goons to fight Bruce Leroy. It all comes to a head at this warehouse where then Shonuff also shows up. Mind you, Shonuff at this point has destroyed the family business, which is a pizzeria, and further antagonizing Bruce Leroy. He also embarrasses Bruce Leroy at his own dojo by forcing him to kiss his feet instead of beating up his students. It's very crazy, very brutal, actually, kind of mean, but it all comes to a head at this warehouse where then Bruce Leroy realizes that the master is within himself, where then he achieves the glow, even though Shonuff already has his glow, but they fight the glow together, and then he defeats Shonuff and also defeats the businessman who shoots a gun bullet at him. He catches the bullet with his teeth, a la, like, you know, this urban legend they heard about Bruce Leroy and all as well, because he gets his vanity at the end and they have a party.
Almost 10 years before Ace Ventura caught a bullet in his teeth.
Yeah. Well, it was very Roadhouse.
Yeah.
Which one came out first? Yeah. Where, like, you hear, like, you know, there's like
this came out first. This was 85. Okay. Roadhouse was 88.
Because remember, there's that quick line. It's like, oh, yeah, I heard he catch a bullet with his teeth. And then, like, and they're like, what? And then they just keep moving on. And then it actually happens to the end where it's, you know, Dalton, they're like, I heard he ripped out a guy's throat with his bare hands. And you're like, what? And then he does that. And you're like, this is so...
The influences that this movie had, like, it was a hit. It wasn't as big a hit as they thought, but it was a hit. And it influenced a lot of subsequent media, not just in black culture, just in culture, period.
I mean, this movie was a revolution in many ways. And both with just being a profitable piece of cinema. Because I don't think people realize this movie did very well when it came out in terms of its budget. It was not made for a lot, and it ended up making three or four times back what it cost to put into it back in 1985. So we got 2 minutes with Tim, where Tim is going to tell us what the critics were saying at the time. But very quickly, Brandon, I'm going to go to you first, then Jacqueline. 61%. So now it's fresh.
Yes.
It wasn't always fresh. Now it's fresh. Is Rotten Tomatoes right or wrong?
I think it's right.
Okay.
Yeah. Now it is right. Now it's right.
Yeah,
like 59% was that was rotten, and that's too low.
No, it just can't be rotten.
It shouldn't be rotten. Yeah. I think there's definitely a lot of problems with it, but I think in regards to its legacy, its impact, and there are, you know, at the time, like, they worked with what they got. I think if they had the talent of today, I think this could be like a masterpiece. I think this would be like, so it still stands the test of time, but I think this would be something that's like up there in some of the best action martial arts movies of all time. Whereas this is just like, black people, you have to watch this. This is like epic.
Yeah, I mean, you're
representation.
I think that's a good way to put it. Is you came together and you did the best you could with the ingredients kind of that we had. So with that being said, I'll co-sign. I think that the 60s is a perfect place for this movie. I think it does deserve to be fresh. I mean, especially if you incorporate legacy and all of the sort of inspiration that this movie took and then gave back. I think 61% is a fine place for it. We think Rotten Tomatoes is right. And on our last episode of Rotten Tomatoes is wrong, we all say, maybe it's right now. But the wrong was rectified.
The wrong was rectified, and I feel we were a part of that.
All right, let's see what the critics were saying. I guess this is, it's almost 40. I can't believe it's almost 40 years ago.
It's wild.
Yeah. 1985. It was almost 40 years ago when Marty McFly went back to the 1950s. Which seems so long ago, but that was only 30 years ago. This was 40 years ago.
This is longer than that.
Tim Ryan, 2 minutes with Tim. One more time. Cue it up.
2 minutes with Tim.
Most of us don't spend our days getting in fights or escaping dangerous situations, so the movies can provide us with visceral, vicarious thrills. Most of us don't fall in love every day, so the movies can give us secondhand butterflies in the stomach. And real life doesn't have an awesome soundtrack, nor does it have the kind of kinetic visual sense and quick cuts that only the movies can supply. So what's wrong with a movie that has all of those things? Or in the case of The Last Dragon, sometimes all of those things happening at the same time. Well, as far as the critics went, one person's blast of energy is another person's cacophony. The Last Dragon is fresh at 61% on the tomato meter with 23 reviews, and it has an 86% audience score. So what did the critics have to say? In a fresh review, Gene Siskel of the Chicago Tribune wrote, "The Last Dragon is first and foremost a romantic comedy, and a very sweet one at that. And that's why its martial arts combat scenes work so well. We've been given enough time to care about who's kicking the stuffing out of whom." However, in a rotten review, Roger Ebert of the Chicago Sun-Times wrote, "It's so entertaining that I could almost recommend it, if it weren't for an idiotic subplot about a gangster and his girlfriend, a diversion that brings the movie to a dead halt every 8 or 9 minutes." The Rotten Tomatoes critics' consensus reads, "The Last Dragon is a flamboyant genre mashup, brimming with style, romance, and an infectious fondness for kung fu. But audiences might find the tonal whiplash more goofy than endearing." So that's The Last Dragon. Let's kick it back to Jacqueline and Mark, who have been training for months in a thus far fruitless attempt to possess the power of the glow. Back to you.
The glow was in us the whole time.
Everybody knows, got the glow.
Mm-hmm. And I guess it does help summoning the glow if you wear giant red shoulder pads. Nothing else needs to be on your upper body.
The wardrobe is like, you could never pull that off again.
No.
I don't know how it works, but it just works in this weird world. But if you try to do that, like, that's cuckoo bananas.
It is cuckoo bananas.
I feel like Shonuff sleeps in those shoulder pads.
I mean, I think Barry Gordy, he understood how to make things that were going to permeate culture, the look of it, the feel of it. He knew how to build worlds. I mean, he built Motown, which was a world,
right. You
know what I mean? In the midst of not the great part of Detroit, but he was able to build that world within it. And this was him building a new world, the intersection of Black culture and Asian culture. And so he had to have the right costuming, and it's the right costuming. Like, because the dialogue that Shonuff has, how can you not have a character that looks the way that he looks, that's talking the way that he talks?
It's one of the most perfect 80s villains. I've only seen this movie once, and I saw it 3 days ago for the first time. It holds up. Let's go to movie talk, Brian. Yeah, because, I mean, you say, like, what the heck is this movie? So my first experience seeing this was 3 days ago, and I'm like, again, I realized what the movie was very early on, and I had a ball watching it. Like, I actually liked all the madcap. Sort of felt like Who Framed Roger Rabbit with Eddie Arcadian and Faith, Angela Vicaro. The other starlet and they're yelling at each other. And then you have all these, like, I mean, Mike Starr from Dumb and Dumber's in this movie, and William H. Macy has a scene in this movie.
That was so random.
Keisha Knight Pullum is in this movie. I'm like, Rudy from the Cosby Show's in this. Yep. So
can I just tell you that the Vanity storyline for, do you know this story about why, first of all, like, why that Cyndi Lauper storyline was there?
No, but...
Okay. Right, so that's basically who Angela is, and she was actually modeled after Cyndi Lauper, she's the one who wants to get her stuff on Vanity's TV show, which is like American Bandstand kind of...
MTV Total Request Live thing.
Check me out on this to make sure this is right. Check Cyndi Lauper's age, but I believe this was the whole thing. So Vanity, despite being sort of like Prince's protege, when she was first trying to get some of her music on MTV, they were like, we can't put you on here. You're not really really marketable to us because she wasn't black enough for what they would consider to be the black section. And she wasn't, in their opinion, pop enough to be in the pop section. But they had already adopted Cyndi Lauper, who I don't think people remember. Cyndi Lauper was doing like wrestling shows when she was first coming up. And like she was basically this sort of like somewhat rich girl. Like her dad had like a pretty affluent life and funded her to be in this. And she was much older than what the typical MTV artists were. And so this was basically Vanity speaking to the MTV execs to say, you're going to let this, and the ageism in this is not great, this old lady be a pop star on MTV, but you're not going to let me be a pop star, even though she's basically just got these Machiavellian guys behind us and she's like a 30-year-old whatever. But yeah, like that was this. And she only agreed to do the movie because she didn't want to, after Purple Rain, just be another love interest. Because if you look at Purple Rain, there's not a lot that she has going on in that movie outside of
besides getting slapped around a few times.
Yeah, like I Get Abused and Prince is Dreamy. That was her whole story in that one. And so Barry, to get her to sign on to do this movie, had to give her a beefed up part. And she suggested, I want to speak to the MTV executive generation.
And Purple Rain had come out the year before The Last Dragon.
Yes.
So it kind of makes sense with that timeline that, and again, you know, Barry Gordy, just he's the guy's known for finding talent and just being like to like take you to the stars. And so with this movie, I mean, again, Brandon, you said the first time you saw it was in your 20s. Like, did you get what this was right away? Did you walk into
kind of because my friend Dylan, shout out to Dylan Stevenson, who's a comedic writer, he showed up at my annual Halloween party as Shownuff, and I had no context about what was happening, but he looked exactly like him. He was like, who's the master? I was like, what is going on? And everyone was like, this is the best costume ever. And so I was like, I have to watch this movie now. And so yeah, it was my early 20s, but all is forgiven because I greatly enjoyed it and I greatly got what it was. I think now even more, I'm able to see even more jokes and weird stuff.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Like when Shownuff breaks the TV that has the Cyndi Lauper girl playing, and the dad's like, that's not even mine. I don't own that, man.
Like, this is like, rented. Yeah, no, this is great.
But I fell in love with Vanity immediately. Like between this and Action Jackson, obviously Purple Rain, like I just was like, I don't know how Vanity wasn't like the biggest star in the world in the 80s.
Yeah.
Because she's like Halle Berry meets with like mixed with Paula Patton kind of. Like she just has like kind of that likability on screen. I can't attest what she was like in, you know, her personal life. But on screen, I'm just like, how was she not like the biggest star of the 80s?
And you believe that she is that pop star.
It was a different time.
As far as acting goes, she pretty much puts this movie on her back. I mean, I will give Tamak, who plays Leroy Green / Bruce Leroy, a lot of credit for staying in what he wants to be.
Yeah.
You can look at this movie through the lens of like, this is just like every dude's fantasy. But there is such an earnestness to how Tamak plays this role where he learned to act on set. I mean, he was a gifted martial artist who was a black belt already. But then, and like Cass is literally as a nobody, kind of plucked from obscurity to be in this role. Jacqueline, the first time you saw it, were you moved? Were you transported? Or was it just like, oh, I've heard about this thing and now I'm glad I saw it?
This was very much in my like Living Color days. So like I was still at home for sure. And I definitely rented this. I rented this at our version of the like, it wasn't Blockbuster. It was like the local video update.
Yeah,
yeah, like the local video store that wasn't that. They did have a VHS copy of this and that's where I saw it. And I think I saw it because I watched I'm Gonna Get You, Sucker.
Oh, wow.
And somebody told me that I needed to watch this next. Because again, it was like the Busta Rhymes reference. All of that was around that same sort of like 90s sort of like timeline for me. And like that was when I was like, I still had to get my mom to take me to the video store. This Hastings, that's what it was. Hastings video rental.
I wonder, I mean, in Living Color is such an interesting gateway into this because you can clearly tell in Living Color how much they celebrated their influences, where they probably grew up in the 70s blaxploitation era.
Yep.
But so by the time Last Dragon comes out, everybody, like the Wayans is in that cast and stuff, probably know exactly what this movie is and probably loved it as a result. I mean, you could, there's an argument you made, Last Dragon is even more insane than I'm Gonna Get You, Sucker, which is just a straight up.
Oh, for sure.
Absolutely. Because
they kind of play it straight. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And they all...
That's the thing. Everybody's giving 1,000% in this movie. They may not know which movie they're in, but they're giving it their all.
Yes.
Absolutely. Even the white people that they got to show up. Because the girl that plays Cyndi Lauper, I hate what Ebert says about that storyline, because the line that she gives, maybe I'm just another girl with big d***s from Kew Gardens, that is a bar. Like, it's just...
She stands up for herself.
You know what I mean? But she's like, but you're making your money off of me. And I think that was actually a really great bit of empowerment. But these all these movies, Last Dragon, I'm Gonna Get You Sucker, even Hollywood Shuffle, they were all born out of what ended up being the worst time for sort of black representation in the 80s. Because basically, like, Eddie Murphy got to be a character on screen. Maybe if you were lucky, Wesley Snipes or Denzel got to be a character on screen. And every other actor who were likely just as talented, who went to the same theater groups, who did the same things that they did, they could only play gang member number three. And all of these movies got born out of those guys knowing how talented they are, not being able to do anything past that. I mean, I think Samuel Jackson talked about it. He was in a theater group and it was Morgan Freeman, Denzel Washington, Lawrence Fishburne, him... Like, who's, I didn't even know that. Yeah, they did a play together. Like, who's in the B squad of that crew? You know what I mean? Like, that is...
It's Lawrence.
Yeah, exactly.
No offense to him, but it's Lawrence.
But you know what I mean? But, like, that is the kind of, like, I always tell
people...
It's
like the 85 Bears of acting.
I mean, I tell people, man, when you look at a black person in entertainment, trust me when I say this, they are probably more talented than the last five people that you've seen. Because as a black person, the number of roles is so limited. And so if you are making it... You have to have bars. Like, you have to be like, they're talking about Divine Joy Randall. She's going to win this Oscar. I'm like, yeah, because she went to Yale and, like, cut her teeth in theater and had to go to London to get decent parts first. And then she came here because that's how hard it is.
And she was lucky because, well, not lucky, but she was fortunate enough to get a great role in Dolomite Is My Name. Eddie Murphy saw something in her because that's what got her to hold over.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I remember seeing Dolomite. I'm like, who is this actress? She's, like, phenomenal. Then she did, Mirzna, the...
Yeah.
What's the comedy with Steve Martin? I'm blanking on a name. I don't know. Only Murders in the Building.
Only Murders in the Building.
Oh,
But her first role that she, because she tried to do the pilot season here and lost everything that she was up for to Octavia Spencer's. You know what I mean? Like, that's what happens, right? Like, there's one person they've already decided is going to be this type of role. And so she went to London and she did Ghost. She was in the West. Wow. In the West End version of that, because she did an artist workshop repertoire at Yale. And I mean, look, Danielle Brooks, who's nominated with her this year, she went to Juilliard. Yep. Like, these are not...
There's a reason why Jacqueline hosts an award show podcast.
She knows
because
all the
she has all this information stored in her brain.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be. Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app today to get free delivery on your first three orders, while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
But I just want to say, like, even this, where it's like, you know, Berry Gordy maybe never got to be the movie mogul that he intended to be. But on his very first movie, he made an incredibly successful and incredibly relevant and incredibly watchable thing that is still beloved almost 40 years later. It ain't by accident.
You can't take your eyes off this movie.
No.
Once it starts. Yeah. And it starts with that, with just a classic training sort of sequence montage. And apparently, as the story goes, that's, I mean, Tamok doing the actor doing all the moves, and he's got this, you know, ancient sort of Master Splinter training him, human Master Splinter.
Yes.
And dude is not just like, okay, good, let's do 10 reps here, and then we'll start working the bag. Dude is having him go through his paces, then on the meat, he's shooting arrows at him.
Yeah.
He has a bow and arrow, and he's shooting at him, and Leroy's just chopping these arrows. Apparently, that was a real stunt.
Yeah.
It was a real stunt. It took him like 2 hours, but I mean, again, if you put Brandon and I in a room and give us a bow and arrow and say, how long is it going to take before we actually get you chopping one of these arrows?
We could do it, though. Yeah. We don't want an arrow in our body.
I'm not saying we're not going to try, yeah. But I mean, we're walking out of there bloody, you know? It's and so, like, you see the discipline, and I love that we open with that because it does ground the movie somewhat, because the movie's going to go all over the place with a lot of crazy over-the-top characters, yeah. But it does have a grounded heart that we establish right off the bat.
Yeah, you have to buy in that Bruce Leroy is fully engrossed in this culture, because when he exits that, you know, the space for the training, and
he puts
walking.
His hat on. Yeah.
Yeah, when he put on the hat, I'm just right. Like, well, you have to buy that this is the guy. Like when he goes to when he's meditating on the roof, he comes through the window like Spider-Man.
Yeah,
it's like Mama San, Daddy San. I'm just like, this is so crazy. But the family's just like, that's our kid, you know. And you just have to embrace like this world. If you fight against it, you're not going to enjoy this movie. You have to fully like give this movie a warm hug in order to fully enjoy it for what it is.
And it's brilliant that they did the montage as a start, because that's normally like the showstopper of these types of movies. Mm. And they led with that. So, you know, they had to go someplace higher with that. And that's why they have their version of the Force, which is the glow.
Well, I
wanted more. I wanted more show enough.
Yeah.
More show enough with the glow. I think that would have been hilarious.
The place that they take this higher from the opening sequence is now we're in a packed movie theater loving the martial arts movie. And I love that scene because that's what my very distant, vague memory of what being in a movie theater in the 80s was like, where it just maybe we had less entertainment options there, less ways to kind of get our juice out. But like my buddy Steve Simone is a great comic. He would tell me stories of like seeing Rocky IV in a movie theater when it came out, and everybody gave it a standing ovation when he cuts Drago. Yeah. But like people getting so into a movie, and then that's Shonuff's entrance to take it even further over the top. And now we're fighting. Everybody's trying to challenge Shonuff, and it's like none of it's working. And you just realize that's who our good guy is, and that's where they're coming from. This is our bad guy. That's where he's coming from. And it's just these two forces of nature that you know are eventually going
to
clash.
I also want to shout out the diversity in that movie theater scene. Like there's a lot of just different representation in that scene that I think it's lost in a lot of folks. Because like a blinking, like, oh, like, okay. There's like a lot of like representation in regards to like a trans community, and also like just like different body types and stuff. Like it was just very interesting seeing that scene and like how it's just like, this is the world. And it's weird seeing like Hollywood regress a little bit. Well, not a little bit, quite a bit after this.
Right, right.
And it's just wild seeing that scene and like, oh,
it's a movie that looks like New York.
Yeah.
It's a movie that actually looks like it was filmed in New York.
It feels like New York.
At that time. At that time. And that's what's crazy, because now when you look at those movies that were quote unquote New York at that time and they look like it's from Connecticut, you're like, how? Like, how did y'all think that this was New York?
It is interesting. Just you talk about the regression as far as representation goes, where it was like it was such a pull back from that. And I don't really know why, other than because it didn't feel marketable. It didn't feel like that was unmarketable, though, because that appeals to everybody. But I guess then Hollywood got very safe after that. And it probably ebbs and flows. But it feels like that the pushback to that was just a very safe, static kind, even action movies.
I think you have to remember the press of New York at that time in the 80s was very much that this was a hellscape that you would go to die. And that was definitely what people were permeating.
That's fair.
So a lot of the media that was being created around it, they wanted to sort of like push back on that. Like that's the reason why Friends looks the way that it does. And Seinfeld looks the way
that it does. Before the M&M store opened in Times Square.
You know what I mean? Like they were trying to be like, no, it's not as bad as it is. Because shows like Law and Order and shows like, you know, NYPD Blue made it seem like, you know, everybody's murdering. Mm-hmm. And the only thing that keeps us safe is like
Jimmy Smith.
You know what I mean? This thing.
Dennis Franz's ass is the only thing holding this city together.
You know
I remember
I mean?
My mom talked about that scene. I had never watched that show, but I remember she's like, oh, they showed his butt. I was like, what?
Oh,
that guy?
Yeah.
I just remember thinking, like, finally you can show this stuff on network TV and that's the choice.
Yeah.
Like, I've been watching the Static Channel trying to see anything I can. And now we finally have the chance to do a network television, and that's your number one option?
I mean, I don't know about everybody else was just waiting on Jimmy Smits, but we didn't get that until he went to Law & Order. So, you know, went to L.A. Law.
So what's our favorite standout performance here? Brandon, start with you. Is it just the over-the-topness baddie that is
Julius
Carey
has shown up? It has to be, because he sells that character that's completely, it's one of the most off-the-wall, like, I'm doing, a sleeve of villains on my arm. I'm doing villains and heroes.
Can we see some
right?
of the goods?
I mean, like right now I got Ghostface, yeah. I got Joker, and I got Lil Zay from City of God.
Yeah.
Showing up is going on here.
Yes.
Like, he's so crazy. And just this outfit, his whole aesthetic.
Yeah.
Yeah.
To the point where I'm like, I don't think Bruce Leroy beats him.
Yeah.
He's one of those villains where you're like, I know you need a happy ending, but I don't think the good guy wins in this final battle.
Kind of like Voldemort. I feel like Voldemort brought his C-minus game to that end fight of Deathly Hallows Part 2.
Harry just got very lucky that they actually destroyed all the... I've talked about this ad nauseum before. Harry got very lucky that they destroyed all the Horcruxes.
Yeah.
And that's what threw Voldemort off his game. Because he was like, how did this actually happen?
It shook
happen?
Him. Yeah,
He's
it
like,
shook
I split
him.
My soul into right. like... six different parts because he didn't know about Harry yet.
Yeah.
So it's like...
We're in the thick of March Madness. That was NC State beating Houston. That was UNLV losing in the tournament. Like there's no way that should have... Yeah. If you ran it back...
I think the only reason why it was is the braggadocious nature of Shownuff. Like, look, this is hip-hop culture, and there was very much a part of hip-hop culture mm-hmm. that says, I'm the baddest before you actually do it. But then we have the battle. And the only reason why you have to temper that just slightly is because if you say you are the baddest, you have to back it up. And I think for Shownuff, the reason why he ended up losing that battle is he really didn't give Leroy a chance at beating him at all. And so when he saw him have the glow, that was like Voldemort destroying the Horcruxes, which I will say, I think Shownuff is the greatest character, but I really want to give it up for Tay-Mac because I remember the first time I saw this. And when he does the glow, I thought that was like, hot, like Lord of the Rings level CGI.
Okay.
I thought that was the coolest visual effect to ever happen. I was like, this is cinema.
George Lucas like, kicking himself for not having
seriously,
that be the Force.
Like this was like when they show you the first like one of the Imperial
Cruisers. Star Destroyer. Yeah.
Yeah, when it just comes across the screen and you're like, it's still going. Like mm-hmm. that's the wonder that I felt when I first saw him do that. So I have to give him up for that because he's Gal Gadot in the first Wonder Woman. He is so earnestly like, yeah, she doesn't think she's going to date me, but she actually is. You know, all of that is much harder to play than the biggest, loudest, I'm the baddest, and who doesn't know it? Like, that's an easier role to play. It's harder to do that.
Okay.
Because he has the ability of Superman, but the whole movie, he's Clark Kent and Superman 2, where he just like acts like he doesn't have these powers. And so, like the kiss my feet scene, when he's at his dojo and he's teaching all these kids, and then here comes Shownuff, and he's like, "You got to kiss my feet." We know he's going to kick the crap out of him, but he does it anyway, and he's like so respectful to a maddening fault with the audience. Because like, look dude, we know you're the good guy here. We want you to get the girl. We want you to defeat Shownuff. We want you to find the glow. Like, just do the stuff. And because he's such a good kid, it just takes the whole movie for that to happen.
Yeah. And I will say the rom-com aspect of it plays so well. It's just unfortunate that everything outside of her story that is not part of the rom-com doesn't. Because when they are like giving each other googly eyes, I was like, this is love.
Oh, wow. Okay. Okay.
Yeah. Like when they were doing their little, not sex scene, but they're like, I'm falling in love with you scene.
I felt like the little brother every time they looked at each other. I'm like, man, she don't like you like that. That's how I felt. I was like, I don't buy this. Like, that might just be Brandon being a hater.
I think you're a little bit too loved and vanity to believe this corny
Maybe. Maybe.
Sorry.
I think Tay-Mac got so lucky that little brother wasn't older. Like because if little brother had 5 more years on him, then that personality is just going to win over Laura in a way that Tay-Mac, all the karate's great. Thanks for saving the day. I'm going with little brother.
Yeah, he got thrown in a trash can and still like, I could get here more quicker than you.
Just scrappy, you know?
He did the robot out of like constraints. Like,
but I honestly think Vanity might be the best in this whole movie simply because you buy her as everything. You buy her as a credible love interest. Mm-hmm. I think she's really good at conveying that to against Tay-Mac where it's like, you can tell that there's some sort of chemistry here, and he's obviously trying to fight it and stay in his, you know, monk-like discipline. But
Jedi.
She's not throwing herself at him, but she also clearly there's an attraction. And I think that the performance walks that line. And so to have that, you know, in this movie where there's all these, you know, over-the-top kind of Bond villains. And it also, I think that this movie, it doesn't indict itself as much as it does just kind of like, hold up the microscope to every like silly action movie that we all grew up with where the villains are ridiculous. Like they're all Dr. Evil.
Yeah.
Including Eddie Arcadian, who has this weird beast in a fish tank that we don't even know what it is. We just know it's not good.
Eddie Arcadian.
So I imagine it's Piranhas, right?
That's it's like gotta be something like that.
I mean, I don't think they had the budget for Piranhas, but that's what they're
they had the budget to make the water bubble in a menacing manner. Yeah.
I will also say that the lesson and the reason why she's the smartest woman in the movie, the Vanity's character is, she understands the lesson that it takes a lot of women, a lot of therapy and bad men to know, and that is find a kind man. Okay, kids, find the kind man. She's making the right decision.
I just worry about their first day when they go to the movie theater and she sees that he's eating popcorn with chopsticks. She might be like, this ain't the move. Like, what are you doing?
It's like, dude, we get it. You like martial arts. You don't have to sell it this hard, man.
Also, I believe
he was
Asian.
We're at a fine restaurant. Can you take the hat off, please?
I thought he was Asian for like the longest time until he did a screening at the Alamo Draft House where I met him and he's like, no, I'm not Asian. And I was like,
Did you bring up something?
It was like when I found out
you signed my Chinese food menu and he...
No, he just said it in the Q&A and I was like, this is like finding out John B. is white.
Wow.
Like, it was like a whole thing. I was like, no, John B. is black. He's a light-skinned brother. And they're like, no, he's not. He's white. And I was like, no, this is what it was. When I found out he wasn't Asian, I was like, what? He's not.
Look, we mentioned all of the many kind of up-and-comers that pop into this movie, like William H. Macy,
yes.
a Mike Starr, Keisha Knight Pulliam. But we should also mention Ernie Reyes Jr., who Brandon and I just pretty much refer to as Kino, because he was so transcendentally good in Ninja Turtles 2, The Secret of the Ooze, and just an effervescent personality, kick-ass martial artist, and you see the roots of that here.
And his dad, too.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Because his dad was with him in Surf Ninjas. They both were part of that bomb. But, you know, Kino's a legendary character because I think, one, I was around that age when that movie came out. And so, like, that was my door into, because I'm not going to be like, I'm a turtle. You know what I mean? So that was like kind of the window into that world.
I was the same way. We needed to see a human interact with the turtles to be like, oh, now I can like get into their club.
Yeah. And then you also kind of saw, it was weird, like from a kid from the suburbs, you kind of saw through Kino, and I get this is very like, and listen to me, how you get into gang culture, because he got, you know, with the Foot Clan and everything.
That's why
he has
cautionary
community.
Tale.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, this was the backlash about Secret of the Ooze. Correct me if I'm wrong. The first Turtles was very dark, too dark.
Yes.
And they were like,
they took away the weapons.
Yeah. They're like, we can't do it like this. And then Secret of the Ooze was more of like the kid version.
It was
right?
more bright and fun, and the jokes were flying even faster.
Yeah.
Michelangelo's unhinged in that one.
Yeah. Oh, he's a nutcase.
Yeah, he's just bursting the bruise like, ow! They're like, what? Michelangelo, you okay?
But I maintain the best that pizza's ever looked on the big screen is at the beginning of Ninja Turtles 2, Secret of the Ooze. There's a scene just kind of lampooning how obsessed with pizza our culture is. Everybody in every street corner in New York is eating slices
of
pizza.
Montage, yep.
It looks so
good. It looked good. It looked really good.
Oh my God.
I remember opening night seeing that. I want pizza, Mom. She's like, we're not... No.
I took...
We took you to the movie.
She's like, this movie trip cost me $25. It's 1992.
No.
We don't have it.
I took karate my brother and I took karate classes at James City Rec Center for 3 weeks. And then my mom found out we really only were going... We were like into like the Turtles and Van Damme and stuff. It would have been into this if I'd seen it. But there was a KFC on the way home. So I wanted to go by KFC, and I think that the KFC started becoming more of an attraction than actually going to karate class and doing like fist push-ups. I'm like, I can't do that.
I was a black belt in Taekwondo. Sorry to
You're a black belt?
I was a black belt, first degree black belt in Taekwondo.
Really?
And I stopped. And I used to do a bit about this, but it was just too sad. Like people were like more like, oh, they're like laughing. My school bully, because I got the black belt when I was 13. And I finally was like, you know what? I'm a weapon now. Like, I'm not taking any stuff from Wesley anymore. And so he was picking on me, and I was like, dude, don't mess with me. Like, I can defend myself.
You're Tamok. Yeah.
He was in gym class, and he was like, show me what you got. And I was just got my fighting stance, and I went to kick him, and he caught my foot. And in my head, I remember being like, since they didn't tell me what happens if the guy just grabs my foot, he threw me to the ground, just started punching me.
Oh,
I was
no.
like, Well, I'm not going to class anymore. It's like one of the most it's one of the biggest life moments of like not getting too braggadocious and like too confident, but also like, is Taekwondo worth it?
You learned that you're not show enough.
I learned that I'm not anybody.
Also, classroom is not real life. Like, yeah, in the classroom, there's rules, but like, you need to be a cage fighter to really fight like your high school
and
bully.
The movie is like, I remember seeing Only the Strong. And,
oh my God.
And it was the movie
that
where
movie
we're,
so
we're
going
to capoeira. And again, it's such a beautiful art form. And the experts in it can beat the crap out of you, make no mistake. But I'm watching, I'm like, oh man, I could move like this next time, like the bullies around. But I'm like, I think I'm just going to like, you forget how actual fights work. Like, go on Twitter and look at any fight in a stadium.
Yep.
That's how fights work.
Yeah.
Where it's just guys pulling on whatever they can, just holding on. And it's a lot more just like holding on for dear life than it is actual combat arts.
Yeah. It's one of the reasons why I do think the like the grapply type mixed martial artists, like the girl that's in True Detective this year, like her. That girl can fight. Like,
she's an actual fighter.
Like,
right?
It's so funny to me that dude that did the first season of that is talking crap about her on Twitter. I'm like, if she saw you in person, you would
Good
be
luck.
A memory.
Listen,
after that second season, he shouldn't talk about anybody.
I mean, seriously, son. Anyway, I don't want to, but I'm like, but that's like real fighting now. Like MMA and like UFC, I don't really dig those things. But when I look at those dudes fight each other, I'm like, no, these dudes, like Colin McGregor looks like, no, I will hit somebody. You know what I mean? Like, legit.
Is there, I mean, we're covering a lot of bases here, but that's sort of a testament to The Last Dragon and its legacy, that it does have a lot of tentacles that can spread out, whether it's in terms of culture, whether it's in terms of just making a good movie on a budget or having an impact in cinema. Is there, I don't want to like Phantom Menace, you know, edit this, but is there something that you would do less of or more of, Brandon? Like if you look at it now and you look at where movies have come, do you keep it exactly the way it is, or is there like, oh, well, we could have done without that and maybe this instead?
I would have done where the main bad guy with Eddie
Arcadian. Yeah,
I think I would have had him when he was recruiting all like the other bad guys to like fight Bruce Leroy. You hire Shonuff. It's almost like, you know, the Dark Knight where they all hired the Joker.
Right.
Do that. And then that's what leads to the big showdown in the third act, because I think it kind of happens abruptly. It's kind of random when Shonuff just shows up. He's like, hey, it's time to do it now. Like, I think if there's like a proper buildup. And also, I do think, you know, this is what I love about some movies where you do like the villain, like, you know, the villain encounters in threes. Have Bruce Leroy kind of fight Shonuff at one point, get defeated, so there's a bigger buildup for that final battle.
Mm-hmm. More so than just like getting kicked in the face because you were kissing his foot.
Yeah, I forgot one movie I watched recently where it's like the main character, he gets in encounters with the villain two times before the final act, right? And it's like the first time he defeats the villain's like, what just happened? And then the second time, the villain comes back bigger and badder, beats the hero, and then the third act is like, who's gonna win this? And I think it would have been a little bit more you would have been a little bit more on the edge of your seat during that final encounter if that happened.
It does feel abrupt.
Yeah, Jacqueline, I mean, do you feel the same about this movie as when you wrote this? Because like, critics can, you know, either soften or harden, or just new eyes get put on movies. From the time that you wrote about this in the book Rotten Movies We Love, have any of your feelings changed on the movie since your latest rewatch?
I don't think my feelings have changed. I've just been happily surprised at how much I realized I'm not alone with my love for this movie. It's not a movie that I love as deeply when I first saw it, but what is, right? You know what I mean? But the thing that is most significant about this one is I realize its influences. I realize how many people it influenced. There's not a single kid that I know that is Black and likes anime that doesn't think about this movie. There's not a single kid that I know that likes any kind of sort of like Asian influenced cinema that also doesn't love this movie as well. Like, you like John Woo, you've seen The Last Dragon. And so I love that part about it. And so I would say my opinions on it haven't changed, but it's sort of like the way it is. It's branched out into more things. Like, when I watch the Insecure episode, I'm like, yes, they're thinking the same things I do. When I watch Sorry to Bother You, I'm like, yes, they're thinking the same things I do. I will also add the thing that I would maybe sort of like add or subtract to this is I would lean more into what I think were the hits of it and delete some of the other ones. I do think that secondary vanity storyline could be cut down significantly, and this would still be an incredible, joyous movie. But like, one of the rotten reviews from Janet Maslin from New York Times was, it's crammed with kung fu, singing, rapping, dancing, and video art, and no moment goes by without at least three of those things transpiring simultaneously. That is where this movie lives in its heart. Like, to me, that is a recommendation.
Right.
That's what I was saying. Yeah. I would say lean more into that. Give me more DeBarge. Give me more the music.
Yeah.
Give me more of the earnestness of this movie and less about trying to make it more than what it is. It can be just a collection of fun stories that happened in this world. Like, this could be a more Pulp Fiction style story and it would be even more enjoyable.
Yeah.
The fact that they tried to weave together this storyline is where it's less enjoyable.
Do you think that movie could get made though today? Because I will, without going into too much detail with the writing I did a year ago for Universal,
yeah.
My script is like The Last Dragon meets Scott Pilgrim in the world of Napoleon Dynamite.
Ooh.
And I kept getting told like, I kept getting told about the rules and like the things that are commercially appealing. And so what you just described, I think you would need to have like more of like the love story, more of like this weird dynamic with
it depends on how you wanted to get
it's gotta be so frustrating as a writer to hear that though, because it's
incredibly frustrating.
Look at all those three movies you just married. Like, all those movies were insanely profitable.
Yeah.
Yes.
I would say yes, but I'm also of the belief, and again, this is my classic film nerd coming about, we are currently in a Hays Codes type moment with Hollywood where the people that are making decisions are handcuffing themselves against creativity.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing I think that is going to sort of shift that is not AI the way most people are thinking about it, but AI as it tools with creative filmmaking for people to not need the tools of Hollywood to make big things. And so I think
just furthering everybody's got a movie studio in their pocket now.
Yeah. And I really do think that there were still limitations on like what people could do previously. But now we're literally like at the very beginning of, in maybe 5 more years, you will be able to make a movie with 3 actors and a whole bunch of CGI and sort of added elements that will make it look like a movie that will rival anything you see on screen. What the guy for Godzilla Minus One is doing.
Oh, yeah.
That is going to be movie making.
If that wins the Oscar, it's going to be a game changer.
Yeah, and that is going to be the type of movie making that is going to start to permeate here. The budgets are going to become smaller. It's going to be a lot because they're going to be able to look as good as something that is made at a very high level. And when that happens, movies like his will get made. They will become the things that become hits. And then we're going to start the carousel all over again, just like it did when they stopped making the MGM musicals and they started making really gritty New Hollywood movies of the 60s and 70s.
That might be the most perfect way to encapsulate not just this episode of Rotten Tomatoes Is Wrong, but of the sort of entire run of this show that we put together, because we're here to talk about these individual movies and sometimes to have a laugh and a wink and a nod at them, but also to say, look, there's a lot of stuff that gets made. It's not always loved by the critics, but everybody's opinion is important and everybody's vision is important, and what you bring to a movie and what you take out of a movie. And that's why we've had such a great time these last 4 years doing Rotten Tomatoes Is Wrong. So one last time, Brian, hit that outro music. Nobody puts together more copious notes than than Brian Perez, our beloved producer, where you get fun nuggets like this movie did cost $10 million, $33 million worldwide gross. The number one movie at the box office that this came out was also a new movie, Friday the 13th, Part 5.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, everybody loves to say, oh, we're in the movie where horror movies make we're in the age where all these horror movies do well. Horror movies in the 80s, man, it didn't matter. Didn't matter what number it was. You have a property,
yep.
you slap a Roman numeral on it, gonna be number one at the box office.
Yep.
So, Last Dragon fighting Jason Voorhees of all people. And I would still kind of take Tamak in that matchup. Brandon Collins, it's so great finally having you on
having
the show,
me.
Getting here
Appreciate
just in the nick of
it.
Time.
Yes.
I'm glad to be here at the end.
Yeah.
Thanks for closing up shop with
us. Yeah.
How is everything going and where can all the people find you and all your creations?
Things are great. I'm glad to be out west for a little bit. Folks can follow me on Threads and Instagram. That's usually where I'm at Frodo_Blackins. And you can check out my website, FrodoBlackins.com, where you can get information about my movie review podcast. That's Ryan Tomatoes accredited it, so we did actually contribute in a positive way to that tomato meter.
There
you
go.
Last Dragon at Medium P Podcast and all social media platforms, as well as check out Drunk Black History, my show that I talk about forgotten Black heroes or events that have contributed in a really, really great way to this country that, you know, unfortunately our education systems are just refusing to acknowledge. You can check out the podcast and everything else at drunkblackhistory.com.
Jacqueline, it might have been his review that pushed this into being a fresh film.
Definitely one of them. I will say, unfortunately, with movies like this, there's so many reviews, it takes a lot, but every bit helps.
Yeah, every bit. When it's 59%.
What is 59%?
Well, I will say, for Paddington 2, my co-host, he gave a rotten review of it, and I thought the Elvis review gave us some hate mail. That was intense.
And don't mess with white people in Paddington.
That was really intense. It wasn't just white people. It was wild.
Really?
The representation was...
The people I know that are into that are a lot of like white British people, like feel good people.
It's a fun movie though.
Yeah, I'm not saying that it isn't, but I have not talked any noise on it, but they have love for that movie in a weird way.
Jacqueline, the bear's cute. Okay.
Even when in jail and wearing a pink...
Let me just say, I did a panel with Bill Wishaw on this really dark movie about women and like sexual assault, and every third third person was coming and talking to him about bear. They didn't give a damn what else he did. Brideshead Revisited, who cares?
They want to hear it in all rooms in the house.
I really want to talk about this important film, Paddington 2, right?
Dude, they were, and it was weird. I was like, okay, y'all stop. Like, this is serious. And like, we're talking to him about, but that shows like.
Like I said, this podcast has, just like The Last Dragon, many tentacles that we exposed here today. Jacqueline, as we close up shop here, we do want to let everybody know our email address is still functioning for a couple weeks until we do our last goodbye episode. So we want to hear from y'all. RT is wrong at RottenTomatoes.com. Let's get a lot of Fresh Ketchup crew members saying, what was your favorite episode that we did? What was the movie that really spoke to you? Had you not seen a movie, then we talked about it, and then you're like, oh, maybe I should go check this out. Is The Last Dragon going to be that movie? As just Jacqueline putting it in the book and having it on the show was my initiation into the wild, wacky world of said dragon. So, Jacqueline, we got one more of these.
One more of these, and it's a good farewell. We're going to have a great time on the final farewell episode. I think we should both wear black. Like a funeral.
Oh, wow.
You want to wear... I don't... It's more of a celebration than that, though.
I mean, but that's what it is. It's called homecoming.
It's like the last night of our tour. It's, you know... Okay, it's, the last it's night like we're wrapping tour. The tour before we go to Hawaii on break. So.
Okay, maybe we'll wear... You can wear a hula skirt.
Okay, all right. Don't ask me twice. I'll bring the coconut boobs. I'll do the whole thing.
Don't tell me what a good time.
Jacqueline Coley. You can find her podcast, The Awards Podcast, Awards Show, and it's going to be running pretty much through the rest of...
Yeah, we'll be there till the end of March, and then we take a little bit of a break over the summer, and then we get geared up for Emmy season when we come back in July.
By then, the tour will be in full swing. So my next stop is going to be in Boston, and then I got New York coming up. I got Seattle. I got Vegas. I have San Diego, Little Rock, Arkansas, New Orleans. There's a bunch of different places I'll be. So you can go to markellis.live for all those tour dates, at markellislive, at thatgirljacqueline. And Brandon, the social media is Frodo_Blackens.
That's right.
Possibly the best handle. You know, the reason why social media is created for handles like that.
Yes, it really was. And I'm sad that we went away from that.
For the whole gang here at Rotten Tomatoes, including producer Brian behind the scenes, thank you guys for tuning in and watching us, listening us. However you decided to enjoy Rotten Tomatoes is Wrong, we're really happy you did. And we'll see you one more time. Until then, don't stop glowing, kids.
One, two, three, four. Those are numbers, but you already knew that. If you want to know what number you're going to pay each month for your car, use Kelley Blue Book My Wallet on AutoTrader. They're really good at numbers. AutoTrader.